Session number 19013, reel 4.
Bob Rose, reel 4.
So we're then in a position where I thought we'd like to get a clean up and went into this act. Or there were no civilians about it. Everything had been deserted. They would be left. Most of the houses had basements. And this particular house I went into, I found the bathroom. There was a trickle of water and all that, so I had a clean up. And then there's like a bay window to the main bedroom and a smaller one to the side. Now, looking out the smaller one, I could hear this activity coming from my left. And all of a sudden there was a terrific explosion, and the room next to where I was, the bay window went and everything went. And the only recollection I had was going backwards down the staircase, because this bedroom was straight in line with the staircase, and went backwards down the staircase. And I don't know how long I lay at the bottom of that staircase. I have no idea whatsoever. But I know I couldn't hear for a long time afterwards, this ringing in my ears and all the rest of it. And anyway, I found myself, I didn't even know what day it was. It was as simple as that. And saw an officer coming up outside, so I sort of made it known that I was there and went out and met him. And of course, there was very little activity just at that time. There seemed to be a lull. He said, "We're pulling out tonight." He said, "I want you, any other glider pilots with you, I want you to rendezvous at the back of the church." He said, "We're going to lay tapes, and they're going to try and get us back over the river tonight." So I thought, well, I'd better get down there as early as I can, you see. So crawl my way down this row of houses, cross the road, past the church and down. And I found a partly dug trench, if you like, which I sort of got myself into, and feeling a bit peckish and all that. And of course, this mortar fire started up again. So I realised immediately that, you know, I'd got to make this trench a bit deeper if it was going to be any use to me. And I remember seeing an entrenching through some little while a distance away. So I decided to crawl for this and got it. And just about got to my spot, and I took a bit of shrapnel. Three, in fact, one in the lower leg, one in the knee, and one in the backside, which I always said proves that I was running away. And chap came dashing over to me. He says, "The first aid post over here." He said, "Come on," he said, "can you stand?" So I sort of got up, and the gash in my ankle was the luckiest you could see, because it had just scoured the flesh away and left the bone intact, you know. And I said, "Well, how the hell can that happen? Why didn't it sort of take my ankle off and all the rest of it?" You see. "Oh, well," he says, "some blokes are lucky, you see. We got me to the steps of this," and this was Kate de Hoss house where they'd set up this first aid post.
So how do you spell that?
Kate, K-A-T-E,
yeah.
D-E,
yeah.
H-O-R-S-T. It's well documented.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. She, and I don't think I ever met her. I don't know, although there was a lady hanging about there. And as far as I got was the front porch, and medic sort of put bandages on and all that. And that was the first time we saw this white powder, magic powder as they call it. It was the first attempts at penicillin, wasn't it? I forget what they call it, sodium something or other. And he just showered this on. He said, "This is all we've got." He said, "This is all." And I never seen anything like it. There was just at the back, there was just a pile of bodies. It was so high, it was unbelievable.
They're all British bodies, weren't
they? All British, yeah. And of course, you could see right the way up through three stories, the floors and the roof. You could see the sky, you know, from where I was lying in the in this vestibule. It was one of these tile floors, you know, which. And then, you know, I thought, well, there's no way I'm going to get across. I never was a very good swimmer anyway. So I'd no choice. I think I fell asleep, pure exhaustion, really, more than anything. And the next thing was hear these German voices coming in, Alice Rauss and all the rest of it, you see. And that was it. We were behind the wire kind of thing from then on. I was taken to a barracks at Appledorn, were set up as a hospital, German staff, and eventually finished up with the order, you know, the dreaded worst transport there, whatever it was. And I was being turfed out. And they stuck us in the most beautiful hospital train that I'd ever seen. It was absolute bliss. And the first time I'd ever seen a duvet. That's all, yeah. An old Padre Pierre, P-A-R-E. You must have come across him. I remember him coming through and taking our names and all the rest of it. And then, of course, he disappeared off the train the following night. But the remarkable thing about that journey was that the number of times it was parked on bridges in the next 3 or 4 days was unbelievable. Wherever there was a bridge, they parked us there. Then they'd move us up to another bridge to stop them being strafed and bombed by. We saw quite a few typhoons, for instance, at various times. But we had a rude awakening. We pulled into a siding and we were unloaded. Interesting thing, whilst we were waiting at Appledorn in the train ready to pull off, they allowed Dutch people to come on board and give us drinks of Advocaal, which I'd never tasted before, and this sort of thing. I was quite surprised that all this was happening, that, you know, amongst all this sort of carnage, they were allowing these little touches to go ahead.
Yeah. The German medics treated you well, didn't
they? Oh, yes, yeah, no trouble at all, you see. And then we had this rude awakening. We pulled into a siding, we were unloaded and put into cattle trucks. And
where was this?
I'm not sure. It must have been
in Germany somewhere.
It was in Germany, and it was west of Berlin, because we started to travel east and through knot holes in the boarding of this, we saw Berlin. As we went through various sidings and so on. And then there was usual hold-ups while track was cleared and all the rest of it, because, you know, the war was still going on, kind of thing. It had only finished for us, kind of. And went right across into Silesia. It's called Sagan. S-A-G-A-N. Stalag. Oh dear, I'll have to have a look at my note.
We can look at that.
Yeah.
How long did the journey take in the cattle?
I think about maybe a week, really? I suppose. And we were just getting sort of tins of what they call soup and black bread and this sort of thing.
What about toilet facilities?
Pee through the door and a hole in the floor for the rest, you know. just cut in one corner, sort of wedge yourself in the corner and get that over with.
Yeah.
And anyway, we finished up in this camp at, I don't know how to pronounce it, Sagan, which was in the old days Silesia, wasn't it? You know, I don't know what they call it now. And I never experienced a cold winter like that. It was like rifle cracks during the night, and that was, you got used to it after a while because you didn't understand what it was, but it was branches of trees cracking and breaking off through the frost and the weight of snow and all that stuff. I don't think there was any great attempts at escaping or anything like that. We did have a bit of entertainment. That's where Bill comes in, of course. And it isn't true. They used to say, said in the camp there we had blokes who, no arms, no legs, crawl in to get out of the billet at night, to avoid the guards, to hide underneath the barrack hut, in order to get away from Bill's concert party. I don't know who put that story about, but it's amazing. Bill said, I never did, you know. They always enjoyed my concert parties. Mm-hmm. And of course, Bill thought he was the glider pilot's answer to Max Miller, you see.
But you had the famous Sergeant Major Lord there, didn't you?
Lord, yes, he was there, yeah. But of course, the Sergeant Major I always remember, of course, was Jim Cowley, because he was the first Guard Sergeant Major I'd ever encountered. And, you know, and of course, he was DCM. I wrote to him afterwards and told him that my father, DCM, First World War, he was treasurer or secretary of the DCM. Holders league or whatever, and he said, oh yes, I've got him down in my books. He said, I got him down in my books. Where's his medal? I said, I got his medal. So I don't know whether he wanted it really for the collection. My son's got it now, but there we are.
So what, I mean, you mentioned that it was terribly cold there. I mean, did you get enough to eat?
No. I remember it as getting a loaf of bread and having to cut it into six. And that was terrible, really, to watch the bloke who had the job of cutting this into six being watched by five others to make sure he did it fairly. I never believed that human beings would stoop to such... lack of trust, if you like. I don't know. And then, of course, you had the situation where, fortunately, I didn't smoke. So you're in a position to barter for another bloke's food for cigarettes that you might have. And that I felt very distasteful. It was dreadful. These blokes dying for a fag, as they used to put it, and willing to give away part of a sixth of a loaf of bread in order to get a fag. And I don't suppose I had more than 20 cigarettes all the time I was there, because Red Cross parcels were not getting... I remember we had one lot, and I think we had one between four. Red Cross parcel, not much when you divide it up into four. But there were 200 cigarettes in there, and these were divided up. And therefore, that was your bartering. That was your money, really. You could buy anything with them, from the guards as well. You know, they would smuggle in loads of bread under their greatcoats at night, and you would hand the cigarettes through and then just hope that he would have the decency to throw the loaf of bread over the wire to you, you know. Because they were, if they were caught, there was always this fear that they would be sent to the Russian front. You could always frighten a German soldier by telling him he'd be sent to the Russian front. So I understand, anyway. Anyway, that went on that winter. We were getting fairly regular radio bulletins. I never saw the radio set, and I never knew where it was kept, and I wasn't terribly interested, so long as we got bulletins from it, and I felt that they were genuine and all the rest of it. But occasionally, at all times, the day and night, we would be turfed out onto the barrack square whilst they did a search, looking for this radio and so on. But as far as I know, they never found it. And then, of course, the Russians were advancing from the east, which was not a very good prospect. And the Germans decided to move us out. We were not very far from Luft 3, which was the famous tunnel escape camp, you know. But there was, I don't think there was any real attempts, not in our situation anyway. It didn't happen. Blokes would take a chance and sort of smuggle themselves into lorries when they came in to empty the dustbins and all the sort, but they were usually sorted out and put into solitary. But then one morning they decided to move us out, and there was a bit of a distribution of footwear and clothing and all the rest of it from the stores, which our blokes had managed to negotiate. And I was fortunate in getting a decent pair of shirt boots, which, well, fitted me anyway, near enough. So they stood me in good stead, because the next, I think about 35 days, this is well documented. This is a rough copy, and I've kept it. Yeah, Stalag 8C at Segan to Stalag 9B at Bad Orb, due west. And of course, we said when we were in the column, so long as the sun is setting in front of us at night, we'll keep going.
You were under guard, being marked.
Under guard, yeah. But guards were few and far between. I think there was many opportunities where you could have gone. Although there were one or two instances where blokes were shot. They were really running, as they said, to use the toilet, you see, on the side. But they were shot. And I think we did something like, I got a note somewhere, the mileage. I think it was 575 kilometres, I've never checked this on the map, in 34 days. So we went straight across Silesia, Germany. And
where did you sleep at night?
9B. They were very enterprising with that. They usually put us in football stadiums and put us on the pitch, and they were on the terraces, places like that, so they keep an eye on us, you know. But I think the controlling factor there was the fact that so long as the sun was in front of us at night, we would keep going, and we got to 9B. I don't know how many days we were there. I know it was there were bunk beds and there were mattresses, which you dare not use. They were absolutely infested and so on. And then, of course, we had a situation one morning where three American aircraft came over, and we had it all laid out that we would write POW on the centre square. In the only thing we could find that was toilet paper, you see, with bricks. And one of these came round and he peeled away and he came back over, and as he came back he did a slow roll and gone, you see. And on the, it was Good Friday, I suppose that must have been the Wednesday, and Good Friday, and we suddenly realised there were no guards, they'd gone. And I went into the office, and there was a copy of Mein Kampf there, which I'd lost since, unfortunately, which I grabbed. And eventually the Sherman tanks turned up, and to my great surprise was the PX lorries, you know, selling with all these dolly birds on board, made up to the nines, dishing out coffee and all, and making us all violently sick. It was dreadful for a day too. And it went long.
You gorged yourselves, did you?
Oh, yeah. Oh, made ourselves terribly ill. Yeah. Terribly ill. In fact, Johnny Howe, I was with Johnny Howe at that time, and he said, "Look, Bob, there's only one thing we've got to eat." He said, "Forget all this," because there was these sausages in tins and all this, which you see. He said, "We'll just stick to rice pudding." And there's bags of rice pudding about. And that's what we did. We just ate rice pudding, tin after tin. Wouldn't look at anything else because it just...
And you could keep that down.
I am, reasonably well. Mm. And, of course, one of the funniest episodes after that was this delousing and re-kitting. And this was done by an American unit, and they were nearly all coloured chaps. They all looked like Joe Louis to me. And you went into one hut, and given a plastic bag, and all your personal stuff, like your dog tags, and isn't it funny, we use that American expression, identity discs, put those in, any knick-knacks that you might have, getting money left and so on, put over. And of course, went through, just stripped off, dropped everything off, went through the showers. And it was amazing, the number of blokes who, as soon as they got under the shower and there was a bit of warm water, they just collapsed. And these Americans were just picking them up like babies, you know, carrying them in and scrubbing them down and drying them off and then powdering them, delousing powder. Never been so humiliated in all my life.
How often could you wash in the camps?
Oh, but, well...
You
couldn't really. It was so cold that you were almost afraid to take your clothing off. And I used to take trousers off and just do the vital parts and all the rest of it. But, of course, we were all... You know, you'd take your balaclava helmet off and hat off and put it down. And it was just as if it was all moving, you know. It was dreadful, really. I think that was the part of it that I didn't like, was not being clean. Not being able to clean your teeth and this sort of thing. But there it is. You just got on with it. Anyway, they got us through this delousing process and all of us and out the other side. And then we were flown back over here. I can never remember where we went. It was somewhere near Finmere in Buckinghamshire, you know. And we were debriefed and sent on 3 months' leave, I think it was, 3 months. And... kitted out with uniform, of course, to go on. And I think it was there that we were medically inspected teeth. If we wanted any fillings done, they were done. we had scale and polish and all the rest of it, you see, to sort of make ourselves presentable. And then, of course, sat on the with double ration cards, I remember. So we had twice as many eggs as anybody else, so that was sort of thing. And of course, eventually I got home, and I think when I was on the scales in the medic's office, I weighed 8 stone 4 pounds. Now, I'd been on reasonable food for about, say, 21 days, 3 weeks. I know I weighed 11 stone 6 before I went, and that was about my fittest. I played a lot of rugby and this sort of thing at that time. And but 8 stone 6. I remember knocking at the door and my mother opened it. And she took one look and she said, "What the hell have they done to you?" I'm sorry. she said, "If I could get my bloody hands on them." Anyway, I taken in and I put on about 3 stone in about as many months, you know.
Even on rationing.
Yeah, amazing. It just, you know.
I suppose you had a lot of bread and stuff you can catch up.
Oh yeah, she said that. "Come on," she said, "tomorrow morning we'll go down and see Dr. Burroughs." That was our family doctor. "He'll give you a tonic." You know, she I was supposed to have been a bit anemic as a child, and my mother used to take me down. "Doctor," she said, "I think he needs a tonic." "Oh, I see. What's the matter with him then?" So and so. And of course, I used to have this tonic. And it was almost a wink he gave me, you see, because it tasted nice. I don't know what the hell it was, but as far as my mother was concerned, that was a topic, and that's what she was taking me back at the age of 23, 24, to get a tonic from Dr. Burroughs. And I suppose the last thing I'm going to tell you is I got on Lime Street Station to go back to the army, and my tunic wouldn't fasten. And stood on Lime Street Station, and this corporal MP came up to me. "Sergeant, your tunic's undone." I said, "Yes, corporal." "And if you can fasten it, you're so-and-so entitled to." So we parted company and got on the train, and that was it, back to the regiment. But sorry about the last bit.
And you met your wife while you were at Keevil, I believe.
Oh, yes. That was before D-Day. I'd come. I think I told... Did I tell you that we had an accident, a flying accident from Stony Cross? I was with Ken Lockwood. He was my first pilot. It was my first flight in a Hawser from Stony Cross in Hampshire. And we were going up on a cross-country, and it took us near Newbury that way, and we ran into low cloud and had to do a forced landing, and we were both injured and took a little while to get back to the regiment. But on that on being picked up from Scene railway station and taken into Keevil, my mates were all waiting for me, and they had a bed for me and all the rest of it, you see, and they said, "Oh yeah, come on, hurry up, we're going dancing tonight." And I said, "Where are we going?" "Oh, Bradford-on-Avon." "Where the hell's Bradford-on-Avon, you see?" So we finish up over it, and Gwen is the first girl I dance with in Bradford-on-Avon.
And you've been with her ever since.
That's right.
Well, we've come to the end of the tape. Thank you very much for a lovely interview. I do appreciate it.